You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 25th of May 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, the US-led coalition is starting to win, or at least launch, major ground battles against Islamic State. But can it win the war? My guests Samira Shackle and James Boyes will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including: are Donald Trump's upbeat new polling figures a reason yet to stock up on tinned food and ammunition? And
the ailing premier of Cuba, Fidel Castro, emerges from his convalescence to address a youth congress and to announce that Cuba is expropriating United States-owned property in that country.
How times have changed. Cuba is now legalizing small and medium-sized businesses. Is this the beginning of the end of the revolution? All that plus:
our cat has vanished. We all thought it would turn up soon, since it's very much attached to the children. It loves to play with them, but now we're seriously worried. Therefore, we would be grateful for the information, if anybody knows anything. Thanks in advance.
Semi-reformed Chechen warlord Ramzan Kadyrov, though that wasn't actually him, we should be clear, is one of the world's most justly feared leaders. But does an emotional plea for the return of his cat show a softer side or a failure to understand the internet? That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are James Boyes, historian and author, most recently of Hillary Rising, and Samira Shackle, a journalist for The New Statesman and Al Jazeera, among others. Welcome both. We will start tonight with the campaign against Islamic State, the ground-based component of which appears to have been kicked up a notch this week. Following an offensive by the Iraqi military to retake Fallujah, Islamic State's longest-standing citadel in Iraq, an alliance of US-backed Arab militias and Syrian Kurds has moved against IS positions north of the caliphate's nominal capital of Raqqa. Samira, first of all, this army that has been that is heading towards Raqqa, as far as we know, it's the Syrian Democratic Forces, we're calling it this week, which is believed to be about 25,000 Kurds from the YPG and about 6,000 Arabs. How convinced are we can be sure that they are united in their dislike of Islamic State, because, you know, who wouldn't? But other than that, are we sure they're all fighting for ultimately the same thing?
I think that's been a big question throughout, hasn't it? As you said, that's what we're calling them this week. Thought it was interesting. One of the things I was reading this week was that the US, who've been training this Syrian Democratic Force, are very keen to up the Arab contingent, because at the moment it's about 25,000 Kurds to 5,000 Arabs or thereabouts. And I think that sort of speaks to the very issue that you've just raised about who is in this force, what do they want? And while they are united in the current goal of ousting Islamic State, sort of if they're successful in that goal, what happens after that, and how far do their interests then diverge?
Well, exactly that, James. Can we be, well, looking specifically at the Kurds who make up the majority of this force and who have been the backbone of such ground-based operations as they've been against Islamic State for some time, is it likely that come the day that Islamic State is defeated, vanquished, call it what you will, are the Kurds going to go, yeah, let's just put Syria back exactly the way it was, that'll be fine?
Well, one doubts it, because, of course, for the longest time, the Kurds have been looking for a homeland of their own.
Indeed.
So it's not entirely infeasible that you could end up with a situation whereby, you know, this Kurdish group liberate one area only to claim it in their own name, effectively, which leads to a whole other series of great issues. Of course, what's interesting about this is the idea that this is all taking part underneath the umbrella being provided by US air power. And I think what's fascinating about this is the extent to which you've got an umbrella protected being provided by the US with local fighters engaging in a fight effectively for their own regional territories. But whilst that plays into Barack Obama's whole concept of trying to withdraw, not engage, one question it does raise is this, which is what comes next? You know, once we've got rid of Group A, are we presented with another bigger issue down the line? Because, of course, there'll be another group of individuals, another group of countries who will be no happier to see, quite frankly, a claim in this area by the Kurds necessarily than the current group are in place at this point.
Samira, speaking in London this week, Tony Blair, who I know is especially in this country, for some reason, you sort of seem to need to brace people if you're about to quote him at all approvingly. But he did say that, as he put it, a proper ground war was the only thing that would defeat Islamic State. Is he entirely wrong about that?
I don't think so, actually. I mean, the recent evidence would support that. I think the fact that the ground forces are going into Raqqa, this Syrian Democratic Force, but also into Fallujah in Iraq, the Iraqi army are now focusing on. And Fallujah has not been left alone since it was seized by militants in 2014. It's been bombarded from the air repeatedly, and it's not made a huge amount of difference to all intents and purposes. So I think that there is, there's a clear difference in what can be attained by ground forces and by air campaigns. But I mean, there's also, I think it's quite, it's obviously, as with anything, a simple statement masks a more complicated set of issues, because of course there's the, you know, there's the question of who are those ground forces. And I think that one thing that analysts have been saying repeatedly over the last few years since Islamic State started seizing significant territory is that the most effective thing would be for sort of local Sunni tribes and forces and militias formed from those to be fighting against them. That hasn't really happened so far. It might be starting to happen now, but I think that it's not just about the troops on the ground, which is clearly, you know, significantly different to just air bombardments. It's also about who the troops are.
Just to follow that point up, though, does the spectacle which we may be about to start witnessing of seeing Islamic State, who've sold themselves as this jihad waging war on the Western imperialist infidel, etc., etc., if they're seen to be getting beaten up by largely Arab and or Middle Eastern armies, does that make them a less attractive recruiting proposition?
Yeah, I think it definitely can, although it's always about, I mean, and I think that's why the role of sort of local Sunni tribes in Iraq, for instance, is particularly important. But I think that it certainly could and should have that effect. But there's always the effect of propaganda, isn't there? I mean, you could just paint the force, even if it's largely Middle Eastern, as being NATO, US stooges, which wouldn't be the first or last time that would happen.
James, final thought on this one. There's been an interesting diplomatic subplot in that, as you were saying earlier, US warplanes are supporting this offensive, but Russia has pretty much signed off on this, said it's fine with us. Should we infer from that whatever it was Russia wanted from Syria, Russia feels like it has got?
Well, if you look at the play that Putin has made here with regard to Syria, I think that the important thing is that the narrative has changed. You know, not that long ago it was all about we've got to get rid of Assad. That seems to have disappeared quite greatly, and now the focus now is obviously on the ISIS organization. And if you think about the fact that, you know, you're now getting a coming together of local Kurds, of Arabs, the United States, Russia, you know, that's quite a formidable a team, quite frankly. And your original question about Tony Blair and the idea of having to have a ground war offensive, you know, you're absolutely right. You're never going to bombard an enemy into submission. And that was very much the lesson that's been learnt over the last 50 or so years. So the question is, as you rightly point out, is who's going to do the fighting? If you've now suddenly got a disparate groups of people coming together, obviously the more the merrier, quite frankly, then I think if you think about the idea of how this is being played out in the press, it looks suspiciously as though we might be on the verge of turning a page at this point.
Okay, well, let's look now at the United States, which, barring some dramatic intervention from the fates, is 166 days away from having to decide between two of the least popular candidates in the history of US presidential elections. By one poll in March, indeed, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton had the first and second highest unfavorable ratings ever measured. By one more recent poll, however, Americans appear to have decided, by a slender margin, that they dislike Trump marginally less than they dislike Clinton. They give the former game show host a 0.2% lead. James, 0.2%, 166 days out, is obviously, you know, more or less entirely meaningless. Nevertheless, should Clinton be worried?
Yes. And I say this as someone who's just written a book, which is, you know, as positive as I could get about Hillary Clinton, quite frankly.
Because seriously, any other Democratic candidate you can imagine, with the idea of facing Donald Trump in a presidential election, would be putting their feet up and anticipating a 48-state wipeout, wouldn't they?
Possibly. Here's the problem, which is that Donald Trump isn't playing by any political rules that anybody knows of. And most politicians play by a set of rules. So when you've got a politician, an individual who isn't, you know, in the mainstream, and you can come out and quite gleefully say one thing one day and completely reverse that the next week and not have the flip-flopper concept thrown in his face with any great sticking power, it makes life very, very difficult because you're playing against smoke and mirrors. And Hillary Clinton, by her own admission, is not a natural politician. And my concern about her is that she knows how to play politics one way, and that's fine, and that's very honest and very forthright. But when you're playing against Donald Trump, who is going to throw that rule book clean out the window, she's not going to know what hits her, quite frankly, when it comes to the general election. We've seen him already come back this week and make a series of spurious allegations against Bill Clinton, trying to drag up all those scandals from the past. And of course, so many of those scandals actually involved not just Bill Clinton's infidelities, but Hillary Clinton's own financial interesting approaches to investment, shall we say. So there's an awful lot to dig up in terms of skeletons on both sides. And it just it's going to depend, I think, greatly upon who is prepared to get dirtier in this election.
Samira, there are, of course, any number of reasons, and James has just enumerated a few of them, to have reservations about Donald Trump. What is, do you think, the reason that Hillary Clinton is so widely and severely disliked by Americans? A fascinating statistic I read a couple of weeks ago suggested that since 1992, the number of babies born in the United States and christened Hillary has dropped by 83%.
That's funny. I think, I don't know, there's so many different things you could attribute it to. I think there's when she was running against Barack Obama for the nomination in 2008, what came up a lot of the time was quite gendered, I think, lots of the criticisms that she was sort of masculine and too ambitious and all these, and sort of power hungry and mechanical and lots of these things that are often thrown at women who are in politics. So I think it obviously goes far beyond that as well, that there's there's the fact that I think that there's a very prevailing anti-establishment sort of atmosphere in the US, not just in the US, also in different European countries to differing extents.
And it is very hard to imagine a more definitively establishment candidate,
isn't
it?
I mean, she's sort of in the White House as First Lady for many years and been working at the very highest levels of government for the last 8 years as well. So I think we'd be hard-pressed to find someone, as you say, who sort of epitomises the establishment any more than she does. So I think there's that. I think both of those things together are quite powerful. And there's also the fact that the sort of left-wing vote's been split. And I think whereas younger voters who would maybe have sort of automatically voted for the Democratic candidate as an alternative now feel they have a sort of more left-wing alternative that's speaking to them more and is sort of sticks with that anti-establishment feeling, like Bernie Sanders. And I was reading an interesting stat today. I can't remember the exact statistic, but just her approval ratings among those supporting Sanders are dropping and dropping, which is a big concern for her because she needs to get those people behind her if she's going to win.
Well, I read another statistic that said, and again, it's very hard to imagine what the contents of such a person's head would look like, that fully 15% of Bernie Sanders supporters say they intend to vote for Donald Trump.
Yeah, it's odd, isn't it?
Yeah, I hear that a lot. I also heard a lot of people saying this, which is, I want to vote for Bernie Sanders in the primary and Hillary in the general. That makes no sense, because if you do that, you don't get to vote for Hillary Clinton in the general election. This idea that you're going to get people leaping from Bernie Sanders to Donald Trump, again, you know, every now and again, somebody comes along. 15%, that's a worryingly high number. And Donald Trump, of course, one of the good things, if you're looking for a Hillary Clinton candidacy and presidency, is that the demographic shift in United States is favoring the Democratic Party historically. I'd also point out that, you know, people are talking a lot about national polling. There is no national poll that counts in the United States. The states vote by state.
Indeed.
50 states, not one nation, as Al Gore discovered, quite frankly, in 2000. So we should dispel national polling and look very much at how these two candidates are doing neck and neck, head to head in each individual state. And only then, I think, can we get a real clear picture of how this is going to develop.
I mean, Samira, there is a widespread assumption among people who pay attention to politics that though this campaign is going to get nasty, as James said, and I'm sure it will, there is a general supposition that all the really good stuff on Trump has been stored up, that all the sort of really big nasty skeletons are still to be yanked out of the closet. But how do the Democrats address the difficulty, whereas, as James says, Trump doesn't seem to care and nor do his supporters? Is there actually anything that you could say or prove about Donald Trump at this point that is so ghastly that he's going to change anyone's mind?
Yeah, it's really difficult to know, isn't it? It's quite... It's very interesting to see the, you know, someone who literally doesn't care if they're confronted with the fact that they've contradicted themselves on record, you know, multiple times, or
it's
have openly
impressive.
Lied. Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating, I think. If you watch and you sort of wonder, would anyone be able to do that if they just said, well, I don't care? If you say, well, you're a liar, okay, fine, don't care. It's just really, it's hard to know. I mean, I think on the question of what dirt could really stick, I suppose that the American voting public is quite sort of, you know, there's quite a prudish sort of moral thing. You know, traditionally things like sex scandals and so on haven't been played hugely well with voters. But I mean, it's hard to know. It's not like he's squeaky clean or anyone thinks he is. So, yeah.
If it emerged that Donald Trump was a male chauvinist pig, how about that?
Yeah.
You know,
it's really hard to know.
But this is what I mean.
It is
a genuinely interesting spectacle. Is it possible he's some sort of idiot savant genius who's discovered a completely new way of doing politics? Every time somebody comes at you saying you lied, you make things up, you've done this or that, just reply, who cares?
It seems to be working, whatever he's doing. And the thing to remember about Trump is he's not just winning, he's winning huge. I mean, the results he had against his, you know, very well-established and very well-financed Republican opponents, it wasn't just squeaking in. The guy was absolutely annihilating these individuals on a county-by-county basis. You know, you think about the people he's beaten that you'd have put money on, quite frankly, getting to this point. I thought you looked a bit pale. Yeah, absolutely. And so now it's almost like, well, where the hell do we go with this? And I don't think anybody knows at this point.
Well, we will have, not quite 166 more opportunities to discuss this because, of course, we're not on the weekends and I can't quite do the maths in my head, but comfortably further opportunities to discuss Trump's candidacy will run into triple figures. For the moment, we will take a break. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Miller, Samira Shackle and James Boyes. Coming up next, the peculiar relationship between one of the world's most feared leaders and his cat and Cuba. But first, this.
Monocle's travel guidebooks are just the ticket for anyone who wants to get the best out of a city in just a few days, who wants to go local and off the usual tourist track, who needs good coffee and cosy bars, who likes a retail dash as well as a culture bash. Join us on our global tour. There are now 12 books in the collection, including the latest editions, Singapore, Vienna and Paris. And there are many more books coming your way in the next few months. Track our progress and buy your copies today at monocle.com or at any Wise bookstore. Cities are fun. Let's explore.
Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Miller. Still with me are Samira Shackle and James Boyes. Now, it was earlier this month that the first US cruise ship for more than half a century docked in Havana. Guevara's grave will have trembled still further today as the country's still nominally communist government announced that it would legalize small and medium-sized private businesses. The reforms delineated in a document outlining the party's plans for economic development are unlikely to be the last. Samira, how big a deal is this?
Well, it seems quite significant. I think if you're running a small business in Cuba, some people already are. I think that under the rules that allowed one of the previous reforms that allowed people to be self-employed in various different fields, people are running small businesses and employing others, so sort of hairdressers or restaurant owners and so on. So I think this sort of formalizes those structures which are happening and will allow them to grow because I think some of those people have reported having sort of random crackdowns from lower ranking officials and so on. So I think that it's quite a significant change, at least on the face of it. And you never know with Cuba how long it's going to take for the reform to come through, whether it's going to be reversed or, you know, sort of what form exactly it will take. But on the face of it, it seems like quite a significant acknowledgement that private enterprise is going to be at least a part of the state going forward.
James, is it possible really to spin this as the kind of sensible, careful advancement of the revolution, or are we looking at a managed surrender here?
Yeah, I think, I was there 6-7 years ago, and it was remarkable. You know, I felt at that point that it was just on the verge of starting to move towards this sort of slope towards westernization, and you could see that there was going to be a transfer of power at some point coming on at that point. And, you know, I think this is just the latest step in that. We've seen over the course of pretty much the Obama presidency, to be fair, you know, a relaxation of the relationship between the US and Cuba, and therefore moves by the government in Havana towards, you know, allowing more freedom for its people. This is great if you are, you know, a small, medium-sized business, but of course the idea of being able to travel internationally for Cubans is still very, very limited, and the freedoms of people on that island are still rather curtailed. I think realistically, you know, once the Castro brothers have passed on, we're going to start seeing moves in probably leaps and bounds, quite frankly.
Samira, there are exceptions to this rule, but there is usually, when economic freedom is permitted or economic freedom expands, concomitant demands for political freedom, which ordinary Cubans have had very little of this last half century and change. How confident are we that, you know, Raul Castro is the younger brother, but he's still a very, very, very old man? Are these people capable of taking Cuba on its next step?
It's an interesting question, and I don't know. I mean, he's obviously quite dedicated to the idea of reform. It's obviously a question that probably only he knows the answer of how far he's willing to take that. And I think it's also hard to predict how quickly or what form the calls for greater political freedoms will take. And I mean, if you look at Hong Kong and the sort of crackdowns last year on protests calling for greater political freedoms, and given what sort of beacon of capitalism and sort of international big corporations Hong Kong is. And
China, I was about to advance, is the weird exception to that rule.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it'll be really interesting to see. I mean, I think historically, members of sort of aging members of political dynasties which have ruled with a dictatorial fist probably don't have a hugely good record on permitting greater political freedoms, I would guess.
I mean, what do you think, James? Is this a question of the Castros trying to delay the inevitable until it's somebody else who has to deal with it?
Yeah, I think so. I think if you think about how personal that relationship was to them, you know, the whole point was, you know...
Whatever you think of it, this is their life's work.
Of course, absolutely. You know, there was it's noticeable, isn't it? As long as Fidel was in power, no one was going to negotiate from the White House with them. And it's noticeable that as soon as he left and his younger brother came in, there was a sense that, right, okay, now we can do business to a certain extent. Clearly, Fidel is not long for this world. One wonders how much longer his younger brother can survive. But I think that once they have moved on, then quite frankly, we will see, you know, Cuba becoming just like a relatively normal country in the Caribbean. You know, the idea that it will become a destination for American tourists, American business and American enterprise, and it will go back to being exactly what it used to be before, which is almost like a Las Vegas for the Americans in the Caribbean. And I think that today is just another example, a step towards that, and the normalization of global relationships with Cuba. You can make an argument that you know, it's the ultimate end of the Cold War to a certain extent, and that's really drawing to a close.
The difficulty is, of course, Samira, is then whether the Castros are capable of managing that without basically returning Cuba to the same conditions that prompted the revolution in the first place, i.e. a country in which lots of money is spent, but very little of it actually reaches the people who live there.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a real difficulty, I think, in any sort of major political change like that, especially something, a country that, as James said, is in some ways sort of quite an iconic example of the Cold War that's really carried on into the modern era. I think it would be quite a sharp shock to both the political establishment but also to the population if they suddenly introduced unfettered capitalism.
Well, finally tonight, on the subject of khaki-clad tyrants with expansive facial hair, let's take a listen to this.
Our cat has vanished. We all thought it would turn up soon, since it's very much attached to the children. It loves to play with them, but now we're seriously worried. Therefore, we would be grateful for the information if anybody knows anything. Thanks in advance.
Those are the words, if not obviously the voice, of Ramzan Akhmadovich Kadyrov, the Kremlin-appointed head of the Chechen Republic. Though Mr. Kadyrov is not known as an especially cuddly character, even by the standards of Caucasus politics, he appears as partial to his cat as the soppiest of pet owners. When the creature went missing this week, he posted a picture of it on Instagram, where 1.8 million people follow him, for fear, doubtless, that otherwise he will follow them. Sadly, however, and with a certain amount of encouragement from the comedian John Oliver, the online response was other than sympathetic. Samira, why do political leaders do this? Why do they put their personal lives online? I'm not just talking about Ramzan Kadyrov. It's Kevin Rudd with his shaving cut. It's Jerry Adams with his bizarre whimsy about teddy bears and so forth. Why do they do this?
It's bizarre, isn't it? I guess it's the same reason everyone else does it. But it's you'd sort of think that if you're
but they get enough attention, you would think.
I know, it's weird, but I don't know, maybe it's a sort of the blight of the modern condition, that sort of urge to compulsively share private moments online. Jerry Adams' ones are amazing. It looks like he hasn't realised he's tweeting publicly and just thinks he's sort of texting his kids or something.
I do recommend to any listeners who have not yet treated themselves to Jerry Adams' Twitter feed, it is extraordinary. It is, as you say, it is unfettered internal monologue. It's really odd.
Had a nice day today. That was my favourite.
But the thing is, as well, if you are Ramzan Kadyrov, or you indeed are Jerry Adams, and I think it's fair to say that both gentlemen have a somewhat checkered history, that would be the polite way to put it, you are, of course, opening yourself up to an extraordinary response, mockery from around the world. They always appear surprised when that happens.
Yes. I mean, you were suggesting in your opening remarks there about, aren't they getting enough attention? Well, what's that line about politics is Hollywood for ugly people? This idea that it's all ego-driven megalomania. I don't think that, quite frankly, they can get enough attention. And this idea of trying to come across as a normal human being, I think, is perhaps one way of doing this. And again, I think the two examples that you rightly choose from could perhaps not be less normal than they are in the eyes of many, many people, quite frankly. And I'm going to stop there before I get any too many death threats, I think.
but they are, I don't know, there seems to be something especially funny about it when it's a not necessarily just an elected head of government or head of state, but a kind of revolutionary figure. They do like to present themselves as superhumans. Would this always have happened if the technology had existed? Would Yasser Arafat have been on Twitter? Would Osama bin Laden have been on Instagram? Carlos the Jackal? I mean,
I think that you sort of you might expect people in those sorts of positions of formal power to be using. You'd expect them to use those tools, but I think in a much more formal way. So if you, say for instance the Pakistani Taliban, they've got sort of various Twitter accounts, but there's no jokes or selfies there. It's all sort of
made by them. But the trouble is, again, you just open yourself up to a chorus of derision from everybody.
I think using social media tools to sort of further your message in the way that, I don't know, the Downing Street has a Twitter account or whatever, is one thing. It's entirely another if you're sort of posting updates about what you had for breakfast, and it's particularly weird if you're a warlord, I think.
but to return to our earlier story, Donald Trump, of course, does this. His Twitter feed does read like the kind of blurtings of a somewhat overindulged 9-year-old. I mean, again, is this just something we have to get used to now? Would Eisenhower have done this? Would Churchill?
No, but if everybody that you've mentioned, from Arafat to Churchill, has been somebody who has succeeded in great part because they have been at the cutting edge and using technology at their disposal to disperse their message to as broad a range of individuals as possible. They've been masters at communication. And we're just in an era at the moment.
Well, Nixon made a speech about his dog, I guess.
The Chequers speech in 1952, actually, which kept him on the ticket. So if you can look at it that way, and instead of saying, well, okay, there's a lighter side to this, recognize that it's a way of communicating with a group of individuals who aren't necessarily going to listen to broadcasts but will follow a series of pictures on Instagram, then it's just another way of communicating with as broad a range of people as possible.
And if, of course, you have seen Ramzan Kadyrov's cat, I believe it has not been found yet, you can get in touch with him directly on Instagram. That is all we have time for on today's Midori House. It was produced by Rhys James, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Hannah Ritchie and Faith Barker. Our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. There's more music next.
at 1900. It's the Entrepreneurs with Daniel Giacopelli, and there's more on the day's main stories on the Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening, and goodbye.